Hello and welcome to A Sporting Discussion, your podcast that discusses sports of all sorts. I'm Andrew Donison, and sitting alongside me is AJ Mithen, and we are back.
We are back, Andrew.
It's been a few weeks.
Just for clarity, I'm not alongside you, I'm opposite you.
Well, that ruins the mystique, doesn't it?
We promised clarity and truth, and that's what we deliver.
This week we have a very special co-host who is sitting alongside AJ, Dr. Merin Sherwood, former sports journo with the Canberra Times and now sports media lecturer at La Trobe University. Hello, Merin.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Don't forget that this show relies on your input. You can get us on Twitter at @ASD_podcast or facebook.com/asportingdiscussion to make sure you have your say on the big issues of the week. We do have Facebook audio message capability. AJ loves it. I don't understand it. AJ will explain that at the end of the show because we have a brilliant special guest that we want to talk to. Let's quickly do confirmations and corrections, AJ. I'm all clear.
I was all clear too. Excellent. Just for the record, that was brought to you by Ultimate AFL Trivia, who have a gig going on in Melbourne on Thursday, the 4th of May. Limited tickets are available. Search for them on Facebook and book your place. Now, let's go. Our special guest host this week is Dr. Merin Sherwood, who has worked both sides of the media and communications fence, once as a sports journalist at the Canberra Times and is now shaping the minds of our prospective sports journalists as part of La Trobe University's sports journalism major. Merin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, AJ. Thanks for having me, guys.
So tell us a bit about yourself and where you've come and where you've gone.
So I guess to start with, as you probably might know if you've done any Googling of me, I am an absolute sports nut, and that's how I ended up getting into sports journalism, because it turns out I realised that English was actually one of the easiest subjects I did at high school, and I thought, oh, maybe I can turn this into something with writing and sport. So I went to Canberra after I finished high school and did a sports journalism degree there. Was lucky enough that in the week that I was doing an internship at the Canberra Times, one of their AFL journalists announced that he was leaving, because I was a Victorian and I knew a little bit about AFL.
You're in.
I was basically in. And lucky enough, the deputy editor who interviewed me was also a Hawthorn supporter. So we ended up mostly talking about that. And I think that kind of also sealed the deal.
No, it's just good taste, you know. You want people in the newsroom that have shared interests and obviously have a very smart sporting mind.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was pretty easy case closed when he found that out. So yeah, so I worked there for 3 years, and I really enjoyed it, but then decided that I'd like to do something else. So my partner at the time, still my partner, long-term partner. he was actually born in Canada, and at the time the Vancouver Olympics were coming up. So we both applied for jobs there. He got one that was a little bit longer than mine, but we both ended up working there. We're on the event circuit for a year, which was very fun. Particularly I worked at the Commonwealth Games in Delhi in 2010, which was just the best fun ever, because nothing worked.
Never a dull moment. No,
from what I can recall with that, it was almost as if they put up like corrugated iron, and on one side of it was the beautiful, wonderful games site, and on the other side of it was slums. Is that about right?
Well, actually, when we arrived and we went to the media centre in the very first week, which was sort of the week before most other journalists and people arrived, because we were working for the organising committee, there was actually a slum inside the security gates of the media centre.
Oh, wow.
So it wasn't even on the other side. They're actually inside. But then actually when it came games time, they weren't there anymore.
They'd
so I'm not sure what happened to them.
No.
But it was just bizarre. I was I was at weightlifting, which was great fun. But they hadn't quite reinforced the floor properly, and so one of the things that happened was that when you know after you've lifted this giant weight, you just want to drop it on the ground, right? That's what they do. And so when they dropped it on the ground, all of the kind of cameras and everything just kind of vibrated a little bit.
Oh wow!
That's thousands of dollars.
It was really fun, and then
but there was no breaking of the floor like you know last week in the WWE when Braun Strowman and Big Show crashed through the
Andrew.
No, it didn't get quite that far, which was good. But yeah, it was just one of those games where it was just a bit bizarre. But I absolutely loved India.
Have you been paid yet?
Back. So I was lucky enough to be paid. I think that the company that employed me may have not been paid yet.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
So,
well, that's how you run major events.
Exactly. <Yeah. laughs> Let's talk about the guns. I know you're still sort of talking about your journey and how you got to where you are, but can we do a quick sidebar on the games? How was that in terms of, I guess, like from a journalist's perspective, there just would have been thousands or hundreds of journalists from all these different countries all clamouring in the same area to try to get the same view. Was it a challenge to actually just get the story?
It was, I think there's perhaps sometimes a bit of a misconception about games too and what happens, but at Delhi, it was sort of the start of the time, I think, when news organisations didn't have that many media to send. And I also think that like Delhi was perhaps a games where a lot of people didn't want to go. Yeah. There was, you know, one colleague that I work with unfortunately got dengue fever. And there was, you know, most everyone else was pretty much okay. But, yeah, I think it was the games perhaps where a few people may have pulled out or, you know, that it was in that time where there wasn't that many media. And certainly because there was also, Delhi was the games where they had some, from an Australian perspective, they had some sports that normally Australia would be good at that weren't on the program, like triathlon. So it wasn't necessarily that big. But the other thing at games is that the media operations setup is just insanely good. And so it's set up in a way that actually you can still get access to people, or you can still at least hear what they're saying, even if you're not there. So the press conference room at the London Olympics, I was lucky enough, I snuck into the room when they were having the US basketball pre-games press conference. And so the actual press conference, it was the same. But the actual press conference room held thousands of people.
Wow!
And so basically, at the back is just this huge bank of like auditorium where cameras can set up, so they all have a view of the press conference stage. All the audio is set up amazingly, so that you know you have speakers in front of you, and then it's rebounded around the room to, you know, to like I don't know, 30 or 40 different speakers, so no matter where you are, you can still hear what they're saying. There's obviously a roving mic that goes around to the journalists so you can hear what they're saying. And then what was actually crazy afterwards was they all sort of broke off into ones which are, you know, essentially one-on-ones, but it's more like one on 30 or one on 100 when it's a member of the US basketball team. But they all sort of had them, there was a few sort of like a few players up on the stage, and then there was a few players sort of up on little podiums around the room that everyone was just sort of clamouring in. So it's pretty amazing. But yeah, I think nowadays, you know, if you have someone in a mix zone, they might be speaking and sort of four or five journalists might be right next to them, but there'll be microphones that are placed sort of, you know, 100 metres down the line. There'll be a speaker. There'll be multiple speakers so that you might actually not be there and you might not be able to ask them a question, but you can still hear what's actually said.
Wow.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that little segue. So going back, 2010 was Delhi. Yep.
2010 was Delhi, and worked at a few other events in the Youth Olympic Games in Singapore, and then the Asian Games in China, which were fantastic as well, where I was lucky enough to cover wushu, which is an extremely crazy sport. So, but part of the wushu has two different parts.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's very weird.
It's
one of those sports actually that was it's been on that sort of list of sports they're trying to get into the Olympics.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so it has one part that it's kind of like rhythmic gymnastics. And there's another part that is essentially combat fighting.
Oh,
so
yes.
It's really great. So after that, though, my partner and I were applying for jobs. He ended up getting a gig at Netball Australia. And so I decided to sort of indulge my fantasies of becoming a full-time nerd and went back to university, started my PhD with the aim of hopefully being able to break into somewhere that has a sports journalism course so I could teach it. And a few years later, I've been lucky enough that that's what I now do.
Alrighty, that was a good introduction to Merin and her pathway to get to where she is now. And that gives us the opportunity to now start talking about the things that you teach your students and the things that you have observed in journalism over the last little while and maybe some trends that you see going forward. One thing that we've spoken about on the podcast before and we've spoken to a couple of guests about is the growth of in-house communications teams within the sporting organisations and how that has had a huge, huge impact on the narrative and particularly the ability of journos to break news. So a lot of the, you know, the AFL clubs, they'll have their own, they even had their own TV channels for a while. Essendon and Collingwood were doing that. That's something that, you know, would have come in from when you started studying journalism to when you started teaching journalism. What's been the change, the discernible change in the landscape because of that?
Well, so this is a topic very close to my heart because it's actually one I spent 3.5 years studying, which is essentially this was the topic for my PhD.
Fancy that.
You know what, that's listeners, you can check our notes. That's not in there. This was not a setup at all. Merin, continue.
Essentially, what happened was when I was working as a journalist, I was getting really frustrated that I couldn't get access even back then. So sort of when I started at the Canberra Times, I think in the end of 2006 to 2007, 2008 was a time when the Western Bulldogs and Melbourne were playing home games at Manuka Oval in Canberra. Yep. And so I sort of go to, you know, the Bulldogs and can I please speak to Jason Ackermanis? No.
Oh.
Can I speak to Brad Johnson? No. Oh. And then you'd end up with, you know, someone that you didn't even know who was. I think I went to a primary school visit with a very young Jordan Roughhead on one stage and all the kids were just like, do you play for the Raiders?
And so that would have been probably before the time that they actually would have run their own media, but when they started to become a little bit more...
But when they all had
more
media managers.
Yeah.
So the media managers came in to control the media. So I was sort of, you know, frustrated that I couldn't really tell these stories that I wanted to tell. And one particular story was I went down to the rooms after a game and the Bulldogs had won and I wanted to speak to someone who had done well and they were like, well, you didn't request that person before the game, and I said, well, I didn't know that they were going to play well before the game, so I didn't request them. So I ended up speaking to like some other third string player, and then that sort of changed the narrative of the story that I wanted to write, which was sort of the colour sidebar story, because I didn't get to actually speak to the person that I wanted to. And so it was a direct influence of, you know, that media management situation had changed essentially the story that I wanted to write. Not a lot, I still essentially kind of wrote the story, but definitely changed it a little bit.
But it's the reader that loses, isn't it, when things like that are guarded so jealously and needlessly, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. I think, though, so the counterpoint to that is, though, is that since completing my PhD, I have changed my perspective on this slightly. So, I mean, I now think that actually, as a sports organisation, it's so valuable to control your messages and control where your players go and control all that information. So why wouldn't you have your own in-house organisation? Why wouldn't you have a media manager that is controlling the message really well? And I do think that they have taken really complete control of the news. But in a sense, I see that it's a bit of sports journalism's failure to do that.
And one thing on that Craig Hutchison always talks about is the access to to players, and he references Super Bowl week and how there is an expectation, or not an expectation, a requirement for players to sit at a certain spot for a certain number of minutes at this time and this time and this time, and you will be available to answer questions. Comparing that to the Australian system where even 10 years ago, no, you didn't request that player 2.5 hours ago, therefore you can't talk to them now. I think that I would love the open access. If you look at it from a sporting club's perspective, of course they'd like to say, no, we're only going to give you the 3 or 4 people who we know are media trained, and particularly if it's been a big week, like the controversial week, they'll just go, nah, you can have, you know, Scott Pendlebury and that's it. You're not going to have Dane Swan and Heath Shaw, for example. So I think that I would love to see it, but we're not going to an Australian sport, are we?
No, I don't think so, because I just think it's the clubs that have the power, and I don't think they're going to give that up. And I know that Hachi always talks about the US and how great it is over there, but I also think it's a very different market. I mean, they have, you know, you probably can't say that there's 4 huge sports that compete for attention, because everyone knows that ice hockey is a little bit down the list, even though, you know, my other half is half Canadian, so I can't can't really say that too much, because he does love the Canucks, even though they are terrible. But, you know, they live in a market where there is so much elite sport competing for everyone's attention. And we know that that's really just not the case, particularly in Melbourne. It's really AFL or bust. Mm,
absolutely. Do you find that from a journalist's point of view, the journalist's job is to sniff out and break news or give an angle to something that isn't necessarily there before? Does having this access kind of shut off... Does it change the journalist's role from something like, I spoke to this person and they said X, into I saw this and this is my opinion on it?
It does. And I do think that the role of sport journalism needs to change a little bit, because I don't think we're going to get more access. I don't think that that's the model that's going to happen. I mean, if you're a sports organisation, yeah, it makes more sense to actually drive people to your own platforms rather than sending them to a newspaper that actually, I mean, if you look at the readership figures of, you know, the midweek of The Australian, you're looking at numbers that are similar to, say, you know, Collingwood's Facebook page in terms of likes.
Wow. Yeah.
So, you know, if you're talking about pure metrics, and we all know Facebook doesn't actually get to everyone that likes your page, et cetera, you know, it's still valuable at the moment to go into legacy media, but it's actually still pretty valuable now to push stuff out on your own platform. So I don't think we're getting more access. But what I do think is actually interesting about this is I think that there's an opportunity to do different and perhaps better journalism that isn't just this access model that we're used to.
And you talked about, you know, the journalists not necessarily breaking the stories. Has that allowed... let's call it like former players or, you know, personalities to come into commentary boxes, radio studios, and not necessarily be put up to the same scrutiny as people would have in the day. And, you know, so for example, like Wayne Carey can come in and spout what he wants. David King can come in and spout what he wants. Matthew Lloyd, who did do some media training towards the end of his career, but still not, you know, a journalism degree, but because people aren't now expecting journalists to break news to them, do you think that it's opened it up for a lot of the ex-players? And I use AFL because we're in Melbourne and it's all pervasive. But do you think that across all sports that has allowed non-journalists who have been involved in the sport to actually just come in and fit in a lot easier?
I mean, I think across the history of sport broadcasting, there has been a lot of players that have gone on to be broadcasters. So I think in that sense, that's not necessarily a new thing. You know, a lot of my students complain that, you know, why are these people getting jobs ahead of me? But it isn't really a new thing. That's always happened. I do think that there is more of a move to, you know, that opinions are becoming more valuable and more interesting in news because there is less of that hard news to actually break. We do get less access to the players. So I do agree. And I think it's just a microcosm of the 24/7 kind of news bubble that we live in now, that any kind of opinion now as well, that if it, particularly if it's slightly out of line or slightly crazy, just goes absolutely bananas. Yeah. Whereas before, perhaps if it wouldn't have had so much air to go that crazy. So I certainly think that, opinion is one of the really big things now that has currency. And so certainly that is, it's one of the things that actually I want to train my students and hopefully know that they know what to do, because I do think they will have more opportunity to write that when they actually get into roles. But I do also think that there is opportunities now to do different kind of really interesting journalism. So one of those areas which we don't have a lot of in Australia at the moment is the really heavy statistical-based journalism. Mm-hmm. So someone like Matt Cagle, who runs the ARC footy, yep. That's really interesting. Like his ESPN columns at the moment are just fascinating, the way that he breaks down data. And we don't have a lot of that in Australia at the moment. And I think that can only grow. But, that's not actually access at all. You don't need access to anything other than the actual data from the games, but you don't need to speak to people for that.
No, but you do need to have Champion Data release their vice-like grip on the stats.
That would be useful.
Yeah. No.
Do you think, Merrin, there's an issue with, just to flip back to the Wayne Carey episode, which for our listeners outside of Melbourne, Wayne Carey shared a rumour, we'll call it, on a football broadcast, and it turned into a bit of a stink between him and the coach of Hawthorn, Alistair Clarkson. A journo wouldn't have done that because there's ethics and guidelines around, you've got, do you have enough info for the story or not? Have you substantiated it? Have you spoken to someone else? Have you got your sources right? Do you think that's... Is it a problem, or is it just the way things are now that stories can be just floated?
I don't think it's ideal, because obviously if you put something in the public sphere, then I think that you'd want to know that you had some information about it. You know, those awful comments that Dermot Brereton made a few weeks ago about AFLW, case in point, which I won't repeat because they don't deserve repeating. But, so in terms of that, yes, I do think that it's perhaps disappointing that, this wave of opinion means that there are more rumours and opinion going out there that are certainly unsubstantiated. Mm-hmm. But I think too that, sometimes there is kind of that blurring of the lines between, in sport broadcast, between commentary and journalism. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that we expect sports commentary to be held up to the same standard as journalism. And so if you have someone that comes in mainly as a sports commentator, they don't necessarily have the same sort of ethics as well that a normal journalist would have. So, it's that blurring of the line, I think, between is sports broadcast actually entertainment? Is it journalism? I think actually most of us watch it for entertainment, and we don't expect journalism to come out of there. So perhaps we shouldn't expect that our commentators that are now taking up bigger roles elsewhere should actually have the same standards.
Mm-hmm. Merrin, something that we've seen, particularly in the political sphere, and Sky News is a perfect example, is journalists on a panel of other journalists talking about something that another journalist has said, and so not actually interviewing or speaking to the protagonists of the story.
And then being covered by other journalists the next day.
Exactly, yeah. And that is moving into the sports side of things as well. You just have to flick on to Fox, and I know now that just flicking onto Fox is actually something that not everyone can do. I've realised that over time it's not as prevalent as I thought it was, but you've got panel shows for nearly every single sport where they don't necessarily always bring in the people that they're talking to or talking about. Do you think that's a good thing? Is it something that you look at in your courses when you're teaching the students and sort of like show that, what is it like, nothing about us without us is the catch cry of, if you're going to talk about someone, you should actually be including them in the conversation?
Well, that would be great, except we all know that we can't get access to them. Yes. So that's the...
It's all the legacy of access, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. Good.
Yeah, so the thing about those panel shows, and that is interesting, that I do talk to my students about, is that I basically say is that you definitely cannot finish this course and think that you're just going to be a print journalist anymore. You have to be able to do everything, and particularly because a lot of those shows now with Fox Sports has a partnership with News Limited, and so essentially it's very cheap content to get other journalists on your shows, and that's really one of the, I guess, easiest explanations for why we have so many journalists interviewing journalists, is because you've got to make the news somehow. 24/7 news cycle is relentless. So if you don't actually, if you can't speak to sources, then you have to speak to journalists, you know, at least they know the news business. They know what's happening.
Yep.
Usually they can tell a good story or have some good content. So, you know, they're better than having no one on the show at all and just running, you know, static on the TV.
And it's, I guess it's
sometimes static could be better, wouldn't it?
True, but it's a little bit like, yeah, I don't know what the word is, but you know, AJ and I normally sit here and pontificate about things when, you know, neither of us necessarily are experts in the field.
Can drop
so
them necessarily,
yeah. Merrin, you talked about, you know, letting your students know that they can't just be a print journalist; they'll have to do other things. What are, I guess, some of the other changes that you've seen in the last couple of years since you've been teaching that you've needed to let the students know about?
Well, certainly I think access is a big thing, just so that they go into the workplace knowing about access and that it's actually difficult to get, and how to negotiate relationships and those sort of things that I don't think I necessarily got out of my degree. So I really try and impart that kind of, I guess, background knowledge that will hopefully help them really negotiate the workplace. I guess the other thing is that you know, I've had to adapt my mindset slightly in that not all of these students are going to work as sports journalists. A lot of them actually go and work in clubs. And that's fine.
Of course.
It's a job. So I'm very happy that they're there. And actually, most of the students that I know that graduated and gone into jobs are working in clubs.
So they work on building walls and keeping people out.
Well, a lot of them actually, though, they're not necessarily going into media management roles, but they're going into content creation roles in clubs. Yeah. So essentially they are working as, you know, the in-house journalist, which is a new kind of role. So there's a lot more roles in social media as well. So being able to tweet, being able to take good photos, being able to use the Adobe suite, those sort of things to actually produce good stuff. So that those kind of skills are very different from when I did my degree, which was very much still the basic kind of you've got to know how to write, you've got to know how to tell a broadcast story, all those kind of basic journalism skills. It really is now, I think, a lot more multi-skilled different platforms, and just preparing them, hopefully, that they might not necessarily work in a news organisation, they might work in a sports organisation, but that hopefully what our degree does is prepare them equally well to do both.
Mm. Just a quick sidebar, sorry, Andrew. When your sporting teams use social media, do you like them to be straight down the line, or do you like them to have a little bit of wit about them? Because we've spoken about this quite a few times.
Yes.
I like my teams to whack back at people who whack them. Andrew, what was yours?
I don't mind them, you know, putting a bit of cheek out there, but, you know, the...
You prefer what's the score?
Oh, well, I certainly prefer what's the score, what's happening, but also just not the blatant baiting of people. But I guess...
I love that. What do you say, Merrin? What do you say?
Well, I think it's really interesting to see the way that social media has developed, I think, so quickly. And it's the American model to have snark. Mm. And it actually really kicked off massively with the Los Angeles Kings in ice hockey. I'm not sure if you guys know that story at all.
No,
but essentially so one of the things they did, so it was back when they were quite successful, so maybe 2010-11 season, around that time when they won the Stanley Cup. So the guy that plays Dwight on The Office, who I've forgotten his name.
Yep.
But anyway, he was like, oh, you know, should I go and watch this ice hockey on Twitter? And he had there was like a skit in The Office where he put staplers or something in Jell-O, and they said, only if we can put your tickets in Jell-O. And so they delivered tickets to him in Jell-O. He went on to the match, tweeted about it. They ended up getting in a few other celebrities to do this. But mostly they're also known because they sent a huge snarky tweet when they knocked the Vancouver Canucks out of the playoffs and said something like, I can't remember exactly now, it's just really disappointing, but something like, you know, there you go, the rest of Canada.
You're welcome.
You're welcome, Canada.
Yeah, and so they really started, and they, you know, sort of said their strategy was, you know, we're the in terms of all the sports in LA and all the teams, we're really down the bottom. So we can afford to do something a bit crazy because we're not, you know, we're not the Lakers, the premium brand. And so, but that kind of model has now spread off, and to everywhere else, and that you have to be a bit funny and have to be a bit different. And I don't think it works for everyone. Yeah. Yeah. To everyone in Canada outside of BC, you're welcome. Yeah. Pretty close. Yeah.
Well, I've actually noticed that Hawthorn in the AFL, their social media team have really put a lot more work into things over the last 12 to 18 months. And sometimes the fans like it and other times they hate it. Surprisingly enough, it's when the team's winning that they're like, yeah, that's funny that you tweeted about a game just using GIFs. Or if you're losing, that was horrible that you used Adam Sandler quotes or scenes from Adam Sandler movies.
Temperamental Hawthorn fans, I won't hear of it.
Well, the best thing was it was after the fourth loss the other week where...
The what loss?
The fourth in a row loss.
What was where, that? That was Geelong, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was pretty probably. Painful.
Yeah, that was 86 points.
It was the second 86-point loss in a row. It wasn't as bad as Gold Coast, but...
Consistency.
What was happening was they put out... an amusing tweet or something, and all the responses were just like, "Or how about you focus on playing football?" And the social media team would then respond going, just to be clear, the social media team are not on the Hawthorn list. Thanks. It's just, it's amazing. I love it. Sorry.
There's been some good snark and some good banter between clubs and teams and countries and states.
Yeah, I think it's really good when it appears to be a bit off the cuff and not forced. Sometimes when it's a bit forced, it's a bit like when Hawthorn did that. Did they do the Napoleon Dynamite video in response to Port Adelaide's video thing? God. Yeah, it was just terrible.
It sounds horrible.
You can tell when they're scripted, can't you?
Yeah,
when they've been prearranged.
Yeah. So I think a bit of snark and a bit of humour, but I don't think everyone has to do it, you know, just because that's what everyone does. And I think it's, if you don't have the right person who can send funny tweets off the top of their head, I think it can also go wrong quickly.
Yeah. Like we saw with Carlton and their banner.
PR companies to do witty banners. But we've spoken enough about witty banners on this podcast.
Yes. They're very witty.
Merrin, I want to get us all back on track here. Sorry, after knocking us all off. And just to ask about citizen journalism, that is blogs, websites, opinion sites like theraw.com.au, and the value or not of reporting of stories, if that impacts on major outlets and might tip them off about something to look at, and if that changes the views on the types of stories that sports writers pursue.
I think that... when perhaps citizen journalism started, it did have quite a big impact on mainstream journalism, particularly in the US. There was quite a lot of political blogs that went big and made a lot of news. I think that it's maybe taken a little bit longer to trickle down to sports journalism. Now I think podcasting has been really interesting and made a difference. So, you know, obviously one of the huge stories from last year was the Outer Sanctum podcast and their reporting of the Caroline Wilson Eddie Maguire comments. And so the fact that they've, you know, started off as an independent podcast, now been partnered with The Age and now picked up by the ABC, I think it shows that it has real potential and potential to actually influence the mainstream media agenda. So I'm actually pitching my own projects here, but I'm doing a small research project looking at women producing independent sports media, because I think it's a really interesting area, because one of the things, you know...
It's booming.
Well, one of the things as women is, you know, you're told is that, well, no one wants to listen to you talk about sport or anything like that. And so I think now, obviously...
They prefer two big fat guys like us who don't know what they're talking about.
But, you know, the rise of this independent media means that, you know, women can actually have more of a voice. And I think it's interesting that there are a lot of examples that have been really successful. So one of the other good examples in terms of independent media influencing mainstream media is The Women's Game, which is a women's football website. And they did a survey last year of W League players, and it turns out that a very high percentage of W League players said that they would be very tempted to go to the AFLW because it had better conditions and better pay. Which obviously, when you know you're looking at a $5,000 figure for most players, you think that isn't that much, but for you know, it's better than some of the pretty shoddy conditions that they've had in the W League. And so that made the back page of The Age. And then I think that I'm pretty sure it's been bandied around in lots of other places as well, that that figure that, oh, yeah, the AFLW has actually shaken things up. Yeah. And, you know, the people that run the women's game were able to do that because they were closer to the players. They've been covering women's football in Australia for a long time. They knew them. They were happy to survey them. They obviously guaranteed the players that they'd be anonymous and all that kind of stuff. But that was a really valuable piece of reporting that I'm not sure that other journalists would have been able to do.
Or even thought of. Because if you pitch that to an editor, you'd get, nah.
Yeah, well, you know.
Or maybe if you were saying that people wanted to go play AFLW, if that was the angle. But you wouldn't know unless you did your research.
If you pitch that to the Herald Sun in Melbourne, of course, they'd pick it up because it's AFLW. I'm going to say, on that, there's been some really interesting reaction to Daisy Pearce becoming a regular member of the Channel 7 commentary team. I read a few comments where people were saying, would have been great if there were no commentators and Daisy Pearce, Luke Hodge and Cameron Ling, who were doing the special comments for that particular game, had have just been able to talk because apparently they were like fascinating. But then obviously, don't read the comments. However, there are still people who are just like, oh, it's a token. How'd she get a job? It's like, oh, my God. Like, what is wrong with people? Although, yes, we could probably go on about
You want a glass of water?
It just frustrates me. just stop being idiots.
Don't read the comment.
I know. You're talking about the females sort of engaging a lot more in the sports. This AFL Life podcast with Alison Smirnoff and Julia Chiara was one of the ones that I sort of discovered at the start of this year or this AFLW season. And that was fascinating because they had access to the players. They were doing the, I think they were, do they play for Darabin? I'm not sure. They play for one of the teams and they just record up in the club rooms. Mm. And so they'll pull players in. So, you know, like Meg McDonald, just go, oh, come on, have a chat. And so it's that access that they have to the players and just, yeah, happy to sort of engage at that level.
I will bring up Ladies Who League with Mary Constantopoulos, I think it is, up in Sydney, whose Ladies Who League's been during the summer for cricket. And she's got, mini empire going up there with website, and she's got articles, weekly articles on The Raw, weekly articles on NRL.com. And it's slightly controversial to say this in Melbourne, but I think the NRL's light years ahead of access than the AFL for women, Indigenous, all of those sort of
Erin Molan has
been there for ages.
Years.
Well, and now that they have a panel show on Fox, Fox Sports. Fox League? Is that the official name of the rugby league channel? So now they have, an entire panel show that is women, which is great. So it's really interesting, actually. They have actually gone ahead of the AFL in terms of having women in senior broadcast positions. Mm-hmm. Jessica Halloran, who's a journalist in New South Wales, wrote a story about that last year about how the AFL was really falling behind. And that was another classic case of really don't read the comments in the story because they were just...
Don't scroll the tweets, don't read the comments because there's some Neanderthal views.
All right, let's get away from abusing people who write stupid comments. I think, AJ, you were interested in the WNBL and the ABL perspective of things and how they have a little bit more access with the players.
Yeah, we've had Sally Phillips on the show who's told us, and we've been to WNBL games where the players come out onto the court afterwards, after the game, and chat to the kids and pose for photos and things like that. And I've been doing a lot of ABL writing over the summer where the players are just happy to talk and everyone's available, everyone's happy to talk to you. I do wonder if the AFL players and NRL players and Super Rugby and that are keen to do that, but they're just not allowed to. What do you think?
I I think it's an interesting one, and I think overall I would love to see actually just better sports stories being told. And I think that if there's a chance to actually go and speak to people, that you can get more access and get more insight. And usually actually those players in those leagues actually have really good stories because they're not full-time professionals the whole time. And so you get kind of a human element to it as well.
Like the Mark Hamburger stories from last year is fascinating.
But the reality of a commercial newsroom is these days is that you need to sell papers and you need to get clicks. And so Jake Nile, when he was still with The Age a few years ago, wrote this story that essentially said that, you know, a story about someone doing their hamstring at Collingwood or Essendon would get three times as many clicks as a story about the financial future of North Melbourne. And so when you think about it in those terms, it makes a lot of sense as to why every tiny detail about an AFL club makes really big news and fills the papers, when you might have a really great WNBL story or ABL story or even Super Rugby or you know, Storm or the A-League clubs compared to AFL don't get as much. Is that there's just not space for them when AFL is just where the demand is.
Super Rugby's only getting one kind of coverage at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. This is the coverage it deserves, really. No, as in those articles, like looking at the political farce that it's turned into. You talk about, you know, the articles about Collingwood getting more clicks, and that's an interesting, like, term. Like, we're not talking about people buying papers anymore, we're talking about clicks. And classic example, Anzac Day, people using the war metaphor, simile, whatever it is,
metaphor,
thank you. Just in the headline, there was an article written by Mark Robinson about the Essendon versus Collingwood match, and it was, the headline was something about, like, comparing sport to war.
Yeah, it said the game confirmed that football is war and something, something, the Bombers are back or something like that. And the article wasn't like that at all.
The article had nothing to do with that. It was just that headline to get the clickety-click.
So the original, and that, so the original story that he wrote, which was it was from someone very high up in the army, who I can't remember exactly who it was, but who had actually compared sport to war in a speech before the game
during the pre-match lunch.
And so he was like, I think the gist of the article, which is actually interesting, right, is that someone has actually said, who obviously has that experience, says actually there are a lot of similarities between sport and war. You know, I don't necessarily believe that, but that's obviously what someone said, so he was reporting that. But the headline and the way that I think the article was written, it didn't really come across as that. I don't think there was that level of subtlety there. It was very much there. but you know, that's the battle between journalists and sub-editors who write the headline has been ongoing for a very, very long time, in that the headline is usually always... one, you have to capture the whole story in a headline. Two, you have to actually get people's attention with it so they actually read the story. So the headlines are always going to be probably more sensationalist. But yes, I do think, you know, we now live in this world where clicks do matter. And so getting people to click on a story is important. I also think, though, that now, you know, with the Facebook generation and the way that news spreads on social media, it is also very easy for someone to just read the headline, to read the one line that's in the Facebook post, and then make the comment underneath it without actually reading the story. And so even if there was a different kind of message conveyed in the article, it's very easy for that to get lost.
That was an interesting part of that. A lot of journos were responding to people's response saying, have you read the article? I don't need to read the article because it's ridiculous, a headline. Have you read the article? So,
but this is a problem area that you touch on, Maren, in the headlines for clicks, because clicks have no emotion. They're not happy. They're not sad. It doesn't matter if it's rage or if it's genuine interest. They're just a number. And is this... I mean, there's examples. You look at every day. We could log on now and have a look, and there'd be examples everywhere of things that are either contrary to the story or put a completely different spin on the story, like you said. This can't be a good thing for good journalism.
Well, no. If you look at the, you know, the essential reason why journalism exists, which is to hold the people to account, to hold the fourth estate to account, which is essentially, you know, big business and institutions in society, then journalism isn't really doing that. Unfortunately, though, I do think there's a bit of a disconnect between what we hope journalism is and the reality of it. And I'm very conscious of that, particularly when I teach students and kind of setting expectations of what they can actually do. There were some comments earlier in the year about people that were waiting outside James Heard's house and waiting outside to speak to his wife and everything. And there was some people sort of saying, you know, this isn't ethical, you shouldn't be doing it, the individual journalists are really bad for doing this. And I thought that was a bit unfair because I had to go on stakeouts when I was in Canberra because I was in the era of Todd Carney.
Yep, I was at All Bar None that night.
Which one? There was multiple times.
True.
So I had to go into a stakeout and I didn't have a choice in that matter. I was a young journalist. I didn't have any agency. So I would think that there would be young journalists out there that are doing things that they're not necessarily comfortable with, but they're being told by editors and other people in the newsroom. So I think it's difficult when a lot of news these days, we're kind of stuck in this pattern where you have to get the news and you publish it. And perhaps there's a lot of people in the newsroom, and actually there's probably more than not, that don't really agree with what's happening, but you get so caught up in it and you just have to do what you do to do your job because you have to get a story up in 30 minutes or you have to get a radio bulletin out in 10 minutes and you just have to do it. And the constant thing about journalism, which is really draining, is that, you know, there are constant deadlines and constant stories and everything you can be writing. And I don't really know how we're going to be able to step back and reevaluate that when we're in this cycle. But I think it's something that we should really start to consider, and it has to happen at the higher level in journalism because it's not going to be the young journalists at the bottom who have a say in the matter.
One last question before we wrap it up for episode 55. And it's about your students, and put yourself in their shoes for a moment. A lot of the sports coverage we take in around Australia, and especially from the US through ESPN, Fox Sports, all those sort of things, are high tempo, hyper opinion, hot take. Andrew doesn't like hot takes. Hot take kind of coverage, let's not call it journalism. Do students see that and kind of think, well, this is the way we have to go now, particularly with access limited, or do you think our future sports writers are savvy enough to know that a good story will always beat an angry rant?
Well, I think what was really interesting for me earlier this year was I challenged the students I forced them into groups and then I challenged them to come up with ideas. If you were going to come up with a perfect sports media product now, what would it be? What's not out there? What would you like to see more of? And the main sort of, overriding theme that came through all of them was we've had enough of the over-the-top kind of David King style analysis and the every tiny thing being actually hammered in. And what we want is more human interest stories. And really what we want is something a bit more lighthearted. We want more humour. Mm-hmm. So I think that was really interesting, and I think we're now in a space where actually that's being welcomed and there's more. I mean, you know, Titus O'Reilly's been a huge success. So I think that there is more space for that actually we've taken sport very seriously for a long time, and that actually I think there's now scope to take it a little bit differently. So it's really interesting because I think that my students are actually pretty aware of that and what's happening, but they don't necessarily think that they need to buy into that model and that maybe they can do something different. And a lot of them now, you know, have their own blogs, they have their own Facebook pages where they're doing kind of funny things. Like, do you guys know the Carlton Draft, which is don't agree with all the things they post there, but I have a couple of students that are involved in that. And so, you know, they're still creating essentially a sport media product. It's just very different from a newspaper.
Yeah, I gotta say, you don't have to tell us about like Greenfield Post, Carlton
Jones. Andrew's not big on sports satire sites or sports humour sites, are you?
Humour to a point is okay, but it's the prevalence of the sports satire and everything. It's the hot take mentality. Like, everything's funny and everything, like, absolutely everything has to be taken the piss out of. It's like, oh, it's exhausting. I'm old.
Jeez.
Is there anything that you do like?
Oh, thank you.
I like a lot of things. I'm actually quite a positive person, but apparently it doesn't come across that way.
No, our listeners to a sporting discussion would not believe that for a second.
Oh, no. Weird. Maybe it's when I put a microphone in my hand, I just get cranky and angry.
You get old. You get old and serious.
All right. That'll do. Meron, thank you very, very much for joining us here on a sporting discussion to give us your insights into the world of journalism and sports journalism and what you're trying to, you know, teach the next generation of sports journalists. It's been fascinating to have a chat.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, been brilliant. And that is it for episode 55 of A Sporting Discussion. I really enjoyed that, Andrew.
That was great.
Yeah. Fantastic. Remember, folks, if there's anything you would like to talk to us about, or if you want to take us to task over anything we've discussed in this week's show or any of the previous shows.
Or if you think that maybe I am a positive person, let us know.
No, you stop writing letters, Andrew's mum. You can get us on Twitter at @ASD_podcast or facebook.com/asportingdiscussion. Tell your friends to subscribe to A Sporting Discussion on whatever podcast service they use. We're on pretty much all of them, but if you can't find us, let us know. We recommend you listen via Wooshka. Now, I'm going to read a link out, which I know is bad practice, but here we go. Go to player.wooshka.com/shows/asportingdiscussion. We're going to put that in the show notes, but I just had to put it there because when you go to wooshka.com, you can't actually find us. You need to go to our actual show website.
Okay, righto.
These are the things we learn. Make sure you leave us a review, particularly if you use iTunes, because we need egos massaged by being in the top 200 it is now.
That's good.
Yeah, got to be there. Andrew, you are going to be on 3RRFM in Melbourne, 7:15 a.m. Monday morning, or listen to that on 102.7 or go to your streaming services.
Yes, indeed. I'm also going to be calling a few VFL women's games
this year as well. Big things are coming. No, tell us about that in 25 words or less.
Girls play footy. They've done the match of the day for the last 2 years for the VFL women's. They're going to do Saturday and Sunday match of the day, just working out the fixturing at the moment. So I'll be involved every now and then on the Saturday call, which will be good fun.
Excellent. And I am working on something very mysterious yet incredibly exciting that I'm not going to tell anyone about right now.
Right, okay.
So put this one here. That's that. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Dr. Meron Sherwood. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.